Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very excited to be talking to Lydia Millett. She's a writer I've been reading for a long time. She's written 11 books, is it? 12? And constantly publishing them, gradually with larger and larger presses, until her most recent three books are a trilogy. The last two have been published by Norton. Together, these are their titles: How the Dead Dream, Ghost Lights, and Magnificence, most recently. Magnificence was chosen by the LA Times as one of its 5 best novels of the year, and I happen to agree. This is Lydia Millett. Now tell me, is there a collective name for the 3 volumes? Do you have one?
I do not have one. Uh-huh. Perhaps you'd like to suggest one. No, the pressure.
I know, it's impossible. For me, the books are about going to the other world, whatever that happens to mean. In the first one, a man who's been raised to be a capitalist extraordinaire. He loves everything about money from childhood. He loves the smell of money. He loves everything about it. And he goes to the jungle, where he communes with animals, basically, and finds an alternative to existence, a different way of life. In the second book, a woman, Susan's husband, goes down to find him and bring him back. Rather than bringing him back, the husband dies there. In the third book, the woman herself, Susan, also goes to the other world. She inherits a house from her virtually unknown Uncle Albert, and a house in Pasadena, in fact, which is an enclosure for a man-made jungle. It's full of wild animals that have been taxidermied. And she has inherited this vast estate and is going to explore this other life there. Now, your books are full of visions of another world, a different way of living, a more spiritual life. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I'm always interested in empathy. And I'm interested in these books in particular, in the unknowability, in the value of what can't be known perfectly, and the beauty of what can't be known but exists with us. And so otherness has been an interest of mine always, and empathy. And these books sort of hinge on our encounter with extinction, with the eradication of creatures that we can't know, that's taking place, you know, in contemporary culture.
And there seems to be this wild fluctuation between the comic in tone, and then suddenly the books veer into poetry, really. It's almost as if contemporary life compels a comic vision, and the vision of another life. You can call it the afterlife, or the life in which all things merge or are one, or the life of the truly empathetic becomes the vision of the books. It's really quite wonderful. Do you prefer one over the other?
Well, I can't live without either of those. So you know, humor is about objectification, essentially. And the other side of that, of course, is, well, I don't know if there's a word for it exactly, but the subjectivity of beings, so, and the communion with other beings in a way that is anything but objectifying. But I find, first of all, I can't live without humor in my books. I can't write entirely without humor. Some of my books are funnier than others, of course, but I can never resist injecting humor, sometimes inappropriately, into language. I think that for me, you know, I have to have the freedom to objectify, because that distancing that always happens when you objectify something, distance is created, can then be brought back and telescoped into the too closeness of communion, the idea that we can step out of ourselves and be with others in some fundamental way. The impossibility of that is also present.
Well, it's wild, because I would say your humor, the given is that it must be inappropriate. In your first book that I read, I think it was Omnivores, a family sell their daughter for marriage to a real estate agent. You know, it's almost as if life is unbearable. It must be made fun of. And there is the vision that there must be something else. And one of the things that I found as I was reading your books is that you have to find the door to it. There's a door, and I discovered in your wonderful book, My Happy Life, that the real door has no hinges. It falls on you. And that door occurs in magnificence as well. Did you know that you were working with a repeating image? Is it part of your inner vocabulary?
Well, that's very interesting. I don't think I did really know it. Although when you say door, of course, you know that I'm very interested in the sublime. I also love the idea of a door in the air, a sort of invisible door. Always have loved it, probably since I read the Narnia books as a kid.
Absolutely, wow.
But also, you know, I'm preoccupied with the sublime and what the sublime feels like. And I believe the word sublime comes from sub and maybe lintel, something like that, which means under the upper edge of a door, that the root word of sublime has to do with a door. But I've actually never made that connection before in my work, doors, and that I have a preoccupation with doors, but it's true, I think.
Now, entering another world and having other worlds enter yours in magnificence, a magnificent troupe of older women, several of whom are suffering from Alzheimer's, they get together as a reading group, a Christian reading group, but they're like an invasion of another world. They appear and they meet in this estate, and they are hilarious. They're like a chorus of hilarity.
I'm glad you thought so.
The employer's mother's friend, the man has been in the jungle. He is the one who survives, and now he's going to other jungles.
He's doing work for sort of to conserve wildlife in far-flung places, in jungles. Yeah.
Yes, and he needs to go away, and he needs some place to put his mother.
Right, and his mother, who's, you know, very absent in her mind oftentimes, sort of brings with her these other women, these other old women, to inhabit the mansion that Susan has inherited. And Susan sees no compelling reason. At first, she assumes they're not staying, but later she realizes they're mostly staying. And
not only
she sees no reason to remove them.
They're having slumber parties.
Exactly. They're sort of camped out in her home, these old women who must be alone otherwise, need each other.
Are you flabbergasted by the things you come up with as you're going through?
You know, there are moments where I think I must be an idiot savant, or at least the first part of that formulation. But I do simply like images of people in tableaus, and so I will create those in inside the narrative without always a belabored explanation of how they got there.
I'm talking to Lydia Millett. Her most recent book is the culmination of a trilogy. It's called Magnificence. It's preceded by How the Dead Dream and Ghost Lights. Now, we're told then, the dead, ghosts, that this is a book of light and emergence into the light, at least by the title. What, as you were writing, what did you feel you were heading toward? Can you reconstitute that?
Well, actually, in each of the books separately, as well as in the last book as its culmination of the three, I headed toward a feeling, creating a feeling for myself as I wrote the end. I mean, that's always why I write books, to feel a certain grief at the end of a book that is also joy, you know, a joy grief, a grief joy. There must be a word for it in German or something, Yiddish. But I always, and so I write toward that somewhat blindly oftentimes so that I can create that sensation for myself. That's a sort of religious sensation. And so, yes, I mean, this last book wanted to be rejoicing in the memory of something.
Well, there's a kind of book. I want to create it right now. I'll call it, you know, The Comedy of Divinity. I think that Joy Williams writes it. There's another writer named Charles Portis, the guy who wrote True Grit, and in his book Masters of Atlantis, that we're stuck in the real world. We're punished, sort of, by being in the real world, and yet this extraordinary daffy vision of something else, something better, something sublime, something eternal, enters. Probably Flannery O'Connor is the person who, you know, dreams it up in American writing first. Is it spiritual writing? And is comic spiritual writing possible? I guess so. You do it.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I do think that the comedy has to be contained within, you know, it has to be playing against something that is not directly comic. So yeah, but I like the idea of that. I mean, I think of the world as fundamentally, the best of the world as beautiful and utopian, actually, in itself. And of course, as our everyday experience of the world is not that. To me, you know, what I like to do is, well, that sounds foolish, but what
sounds
I try to
foolish.
Do is, I mean, if the world is in itself beautiful and sublime, why is it so compelling for us to create other worlds in our imagination? Because I believe both these things, that the other worlds are always better and that they depend entirely upon the gorgeousness of this one that we actually physically inhabit.
Well, in this book, Magnificence, there's a fantastic section, you might even call it a rant, in which I would say sweet reasonableness is protested against. Anything but the reasonable, the good-natured, the ridiculousness. And in this book, that sweet-naturedness, blithe inconsideration of violence, of sexism, of racism, of homophobia, is epitomized by NPR. And I thought you would all enjoy hearing a wonderful section in which the character Susan basically has a nervous breakdown while listening to Terry Gross. This is Lydia Millett reading a section from Magnificence.
Jim was supposed to meet her outside the court building, so she was driving there in her own car. She was nervous, dressed neatly in conservative clothes, with pearl earrings and flat, unglamorous heels, and she listened to the radio as she drove. She had always been irritated by NPR all her adult life, and yet all her adult life she had listened to it faithfully. One exit's worth of freeway driving was all it would be. First surface streets, then a mile on the freeway, then surface streets again. And yet, as soon as she merged onto the 110, on NPR, a well-known interviewer, Terry Gross, was earnestly complimenting a rap musician on his genius, she knew she would never make it. The traffic was stopped, bumper to bumper, as far as she could see, though in the opposite direction it was moving freely. She waited 15 minutes with the windows up, cooled by the air conditioning, glancing frequently at the digital clock on her dash, jiggling her foot and occasionally swearing as the minutes ticked away and the hour of the hearing approached. When it was 6 minutes before the hour, she became irritated with Terry Gross, whose earnest tone, it seemed to her, had grown more and more sycophantic. More and more, the intimacy of this trademark Terry Gross tone, as she spoke to the rap star, and flattered him several additional times with her eager references to his brilliance and creativity, seemed to suggest that she, Terry Gross, was a long-time proponent and appreciator of rap music, and even quite possibly a credentialed expert on the rap music subject. The longer Susan listened, becoming increasingly frustrated and impatient, the more it seemed that the impression being conveyed was that she, the white, middle-aged female Terry Gross, unlike she, the white, middle-aged female Susan, was a proud, savvy collective owner of what she lavishly called the rap music phenomenon. Susan felt resentful of this pandering self-inclusion, of this proprietary, rap music savvy, rap music loving Terry Gross. She closed her eyes and listened to the empathetic Terry Gross tone and to the rap loving earnestness as it flowed over her. "I love rap music too," she thought, making a generous gesture. She would reach out to Terry Gross, the rap guy, and their mutual passion, thus elevating her own mood. "I also find it creative and brilliant," she said in her mind to Terry Gross and the rap guy. "It is brilliantly creative. It is creatively brilliant. Not only that, but all of it is brilliant. Not just the white-friendly, woman-friendly versions favored by college students, but also the gangster version, the version with bitches, hoes, and gats, the completely misogynistic, racist, homophobic, and violent, even nihilistically brutal version. I love it, love it, love it. Mm-hmm. I love it, and I love all self-expressions, ironic and otherwise, all of them under the sun. I love pornography, gangster rap, war, video games, all fantasies of violence. These fantasies preoccupy the insane men and keep them from their actual work of angrily murdering. Let us not condemn these proliferating, vibrant simulations, these models of brutality. No, let us praise them as though they were condoms. Maybe that explained Terry Gross and her rap appreciation. Maybe the gangster rap was viewed by Terry Gross less as an incitement to gangsta type acting out than as an artistic prophylactic screen against it. Maybe the rap Terry Gross and the Planned Parenthood Terry Gross were actually one and the same.
That was Lydia Millett reading from Magnificence. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Lydia Millett about her new book, Magnificence, a dark and often funny examination of life by a woman who finds herself in the state of flux commonly known as a midlife crisis. Now, I have to confide to you that I lived with Terry Gross when I was in college.
Oh, dear.
Oh, no, you needn't worry. I mean, I think everyone has experienced this driving and hearing that middle-educated voice of NPR. And why, though? Because it's at the center of these books, your books. Why do we want to escape from that voice?
From the voice of reason? maybe, from the voice of moderation.
Yeah.
Moderation, I think, is offensive to me in some ways. You know, I'm not a big fan of moderation, I guess. I'm more a person of extremes. I love extremes. Well, I think, first of all, moderation, there's a way in which it, you know, it simply, it promotes the status quo and is discouraging of change and of change that's revolutionary or epiphanic, revelatory. The moderate can be quite deadening at times, I think. And I also don't like the tendency in our culture to try to please, if not everyone, you know, to try to please others with our media rather than trying to embody ourselves some nobler and higher aesthetic that we personally hold. I'm sort of sickened by the media when I view it as pandering.
Now, I would say that in these books, these three books, this trilogy, I guess you'd have to call it the Magnificence Trilogy. It has to be the title of one of them.
Well, I like it. That's good. You've done well. Yeah.
Okay.
I have referred to it just as a trilogy about extinction, but that's sort of a downer for one thing. Well, I like your name better.
I think it's about the question of how do we integrate death into our life. So we have the aging ladies, the stuffed dead animals, eventually a vision of the past of the race as being part of a mammoth collection, the whole collection of every kind of being, and that this is, you know, well, how the dead dream, this is how the dead dream, or these are ghost lights, and they lead us to a vision of magnificence, that everything that has ever been is part of this woman's inheritance, part of what she falls into. It's kind of a beatific vision.
Well, it's beautiful when you say it that way.
What do you think?
You know, I had a thought, and then I was listening to you so hard that I forgot it. but there was something. Oh, yeah. I mean, simply this, that all my favorite books as a reader and what I try to make my books be about, always they have to do with how do we live with death, you know? And I think most serious artists of any stripe, you're answering that question all the time. How do we live with death? How do we live with the knowledge of death? How do we live with being finite and small, but knowing that the universe is vast, you know? And so really all books, I think, that are worth their salt pursue this question in some form or another. And these do, and they also, they look at not only our own personal death and our own personal losses, but they try to look at the death of the world, the death of the world around us, you know, a world that is changing extraordinarily quickly, whose change has been accelerating, you know, over the course of the 20th century at a pace unprecedented in history. What is that? How do we live with that? And what do we make of it?
Do you mind if I call these visionary novels?
Oh, I would certainly not be angry at you. No, that's very kind. I mean, I think one of the things that maybe perplexes readers of my books may be that these elements are combined, and that you don't always see those three things together or those two things together. That might be because the books aren't difficult to read at all.
They're not funny. They're enjoyable. You can eat them like candy.
They're not difficult at all. They're not experimental per se. Even though I love plenty of fiction that is, they're not that. You know, they're not. But it's that very sort of vacillation between tones and between preoccupations, if I can use that word again, that I think might confuse some readers. Anyway.
Now, you work in the desert.
Yeah. I moved from the West Village to the desert outside Tucson about 14 years ago, just because I fell in love with the desert. I love it.
And you work with animal?
I don't directly. I mean, I don't work with animal physical animals directly. But yeah, I work for a nonprofit that sues mostly the government to protect wild animals in the landscapes they live in. So a conservation group.
And
I write and edit, of course. I'm not an actual activist of any stripe, but.
Your husband runs the group? Am I understanding this
correctly?
Yeah,
my ex-husband founded the group almost 25 years ago and is still the director of it. And I'm a peon there.
But what I'm trying to suggest is more than reading, it's possible to choose a life in which the decisions one makes to render the utopian actual, that such a life is possible, that it's not just in books. What do you think?
Well, I hope that's true. It's such hard work and so full of detail and small victories and then followed by defeats. And it's just such hard work. And for me, writing and reading are the great, I guess, imaginative venture of my life where I get to leave the daily grind, which is often depressing, of this work behind, because we deal with climate change a lot, for example, and of course extinction. And so for me, the happiest point in my day is always when I'm allowed to escape into pure language.
I've been talking to Lydia Millett, author most recently of Magnificence, the third book of a trilogy which begins with How the Dead Dream, Ghost Lights, and now Magnificence, which is published by W.W. Norton & Company. Thank you, Lydia, for joining me.
This has been a great pleasure.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robbie Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Angie Malenko is our guest.
Tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.